Well, we're happy for your presence this morning. I'm glad to be here. And I hope the things that I studied are, first of all, grounded in truth, but they're also helpful for you, as they've been helpful for me. This morning, we're going to be continuing our series of standalone sermons about money. And God had a lot to say about money. As a matter of fact, I've read that some 15% of the content of the Bible has to do with either mentioning money or mentioning money and possessions or referencing that idea somehow. So that's a pretty big chunk of the Bible. Jesus taught and promoted some ideas that would make a lot of people uncomfortable today thinking about talking about money. Now, there are, just to give a few examples, there are clear explanations for each of these, but I'm just going to state the surface examples, just to name a few. He condemned a farmer who wanted to retire early. You remember he was, this farmer was selfish, and he was condemned in this parable by Jesus. You remember that story? I mentioned it before. We've talked about this, where Jesus approaches a rich young ruler, and he gives him a really hard, he has a really hard ask for him. He tells him to give away everything he had, to give to the poor, and come and follow Jesus. That's a pretty drastic thing to ask. And then finally, we have this scene of him praising a widow who gave to the treasury everything she had. She gave her two mites. She was a poor widow, but she gave everything to the Lord, and Jesus praised her for that. Now, the first two examples, these men's decisions, how they reacted to Jesus, most financial advisors would praise them for that. That's a prudent and wise thing to do. Why be rash and give everything away and follow this that you're unsure of? You'll have an unsure future. Or, you know, they would have praised that farmer for all of his blessings and being kind of smart with his money. And maybe he'd be today writing a blog, heading up the FIRE movement of look how successful you can be, and you can retire, you can have all of your ducks in a row. The third example, however, most financial advisors would be shocked at that decision. As a matter of fact, a lot of them would probably try to counsel her and say, you know, this is a lot. You don't need to do this. You don't need to make this kind of rash decision. It's kind of senseless. Now, if we look at the above examples alone, we may be led to think that it's our duty to get rid of everything we own, absolutely everything. And we mentioned that in our first lesson, and that's not the truth that's revealed here in the scriptures. We can't isolate just these examples. Now, these specific examples, Jesus knew the heart of man, and he knew what was needed for them. And like that rich young ruler, that was needed for him because that was a barrier. But there are many other examples of people who were wealthy, who used their possessions for good. They used their possessions for the furtherance of the gospel, for the support of the church, for support of preachers and so forth. And those were praised by God and viewed as faithful by God. And as we've already established, money is neither good nor evil. What's good and what's evil is our perception of money. It can be evil. Our perception of money can also be good. That said, Jesus, he gave many warnings about riches. They can hinder the owner from entering into the kingdom in the first place. They can lead to neglect of the poor, because you can become greedy and you want more and more and more, and you shut off that opportunity to help others. It can lead to a lot of greed, as we mentioned, the farmer, and selfishness. It can stunt spiritual growth. And possessions and money are perishable. A desire for earthly possessions and wanting more is very, very dangerous. To quote Randy Alcorn in his book, Money, Possessions, and Eternity, money is a terrible master to those who serve it. Money is a wonderful servant to those who serve God. This morning, we're going to consider what Jesus said about this topic, particularly in his Sermon on the Mount. And we're going to cover Matthew 6, verses 19 through 24. Matthew 6, verses 19 through 24. That'll be our focus this morning. But before we hone in on these things, I want you to consider with me just for a few moments the Sermon on the Mount altogether, just considering it as a whole. As we know, this genre would be like a oration or a speech. It was a long, extended speech by Jesus. This sermon illustrates how masterful Jesus used logic, how he used rhetoric, how he even structured his thoughts to be pointed, to be clear, to have a lasting impact on people's lives. It had a lasting impact on their lives, and this sermon can change our life too if we internalize it and consider the lessons taught. Jesus uses several groups of three in his sermon. You have just a few examples here. You have three religious practices and the proper way to observe them in Matthew 6, verses 1 through 18. You have three Christian life pieces of advice, Matthew 7, verses 1 through 12. You have that hypocritical judgment. You have his teaching not to waste your time with swine or those who will turn and rend you. And then you have his third piece of advice is actually another set of three within that. That's the ask and seek and knock. Ask and it shall be given. Seek and you shall find. Knock, it shall be opened unto you. You have three contrasts later in Matthew 7. You have the two gates, you know, the narrow gate and the broad gate. You have the two fruits. You can produce good fruit or you can produce bad fruit. And you can have a right judgment or a right assessment of someone else's life by the fruits that they produce. Jesus taught that. Yes, he taught that. And finally, there's two foundations as he closes that chapter in Matthew 7. You can build your house on the sand. You can build your house on the rock. And those obviously have that reward or punishment. There are contrasts throughout the sermon. In Matthew 6, verses 19 through 24, we have three choices. Two treasuries, two views, and two masters. And each choice of this three, it represents a contrast. So let's read it. Matthew 6, verses 19 through 24. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Verse 22 and 23. The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? And then verse 24. No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. So let's consider it. Let's consider this as you consider this, first of all, there's, again, three choices. There's that location of your treasuries, whether it's on earth or whether it's on heaven. There are two views or two perspectives. Your eye can be good after the things that are good, or your eye could be evil. And then finally, there's two masters. Now, we're going to talk about these first few verses, Matthew 6, verses 19 through 21 here. I've mentioned this before, but I think it's very helpful to picture. There is a play on words here in Matthew 6, verse 19, and also Matthew 6, verse 20. And you can see that in the original language, but you can't see that in most of our translations. The word lay up for yourselves and the word treasure, actually in the original, as you can see, you have kind of a little bit of a play on words here. And I think a neat way of appreciating the original play on words would go something like this. Do not treasure for yourselves treasure on earth. Rather, treasure for yourselves treasure in heaven. And I think that thinking of that really, for some reason, at least with me, it really resonates with me. The first word is command. Do not treasure up, but rather treasure up, you know, the other end of the verse. And I think this is helpful for me because when I think of something I treasure, a lot of warm feelings come to my heart, and it kind of helps with a memory. I think of something that is very precious, that's very important to me, something that I hold dear. And I think probably you guys have things that you treasure. Perhaps it's a special relationship that you have that you don't want to lose. That's very precious to you. You treasure that relationship. Perhaps it's a goal of closeness with God, which you have worked for, which you've sacrificed to have this close relationship with God. But if we're honest with ourselves, perhaps it's also a material possession that you have, something that you've held on to that you hold real tight and you love very much. It floods you with memories. It floods you with pleasure or with happiness. It's something that you treasure in your heart. Jesus' words, I think, here are more plain than they are comfortable. I think actually this whole set of verses is not so complicated as it is challenging. Be careful with placing too much emphasis on the things that you can physically hold in this world. Honestly, ask yourself these questions to find your treasure. I think these are good questions to ask to find your treasure. What is your most valuable possession? What is most important to you? What would you absolutely hate to lose? What is the first thing that you think about when you wake up? What's the very last thing you think about before you go to bed? I think a lot of us could probably answer this the way we're supposed to answer it, right? I think most of us could understand that. You would want to say it's Jesus, or it's the cares associated with the kingdom. It's our soul's salvation. It's the word of God. I think we know how we should answer that question, but I want you to assess for a moment how you really ought to answer that question personally. And that is by how much time have you spent on these things? How much of an investment have you made on pursuing God and the things of this kingdom and helping others and so forth on your soul's salvation and drawing closer? How much time have you really invested in these things? Is that really what you spend your time in? Is that really what you spend your talents and your investments in? And then answer those questions again. And I think those questions get a little bit harder if we're honest with ourselves. And I assure you, the more honest you are with yourself, at least you have a point to work with. At least you have some changes that you need to make, and you can move closer to that direction that Jesus demands of all of us. Well, consider the logic that Jesus used after he just says, "Do not treasure for yourselves treasures on earth, but rather treasure for yourselves treasures in heaven." Consider this investment. Jesus uses logic to bolster this idea, not just a command. He uses logic right after. And the reasons in verse 19 and verse 20 are not like morally right or morally wrong. They're more like smart versus dumb. Jesus is saying it doesn't make sense to store up treasures on earth. It doesn't make good sense. You have the moth that destroys. You could tell the wealth of a person in ancient times by their multiple changes of clothes. And back in the day, they would gather all these clothes together and they would store them in their home. And that's how you could tell their wealth. That's what a lot of their investments were, all these changes of clothes. Well, these are obviously subject to the elements. And as we know, clothes and everything that are stored for a long period of time are susceptible for moths. And moths eat through holes. They eat through the clothes of holes. Or they make holes in our clothes. They're subject to corruption. Well, also, rust destroys. It's easy for us to picture maybe an old vehicle or some old metal that's been sitting outside for a long time, and you know what that corrosion looks like, that rust that begins to eat up that metal. The original word could actually be more broad, and it could convey more of a sense of eating in general, as in eating or ruining a crop yield. And that's happened before. It happens today. Well, since most riches were stored in homes, as I established, and the homes were not as secure back then as they are now. I'm getting away from myself, aren't I? Thieves could break through and steal. A lot of times it was even easier for them than just coming through the door. They could just dig through under walls and get through the roof and go and steal your stuff. It'd be pretty easy for them to do that. Well, you might be thinking, thankfully, I don't store my wealth this way, and I'm cleared from this. It's not a big deal for me. I don't store my possessions this way. Well, you're not off the hook here. Maybe you have overvalued your bank account. Maybe you've overvalued your 401k or other investment balances. There could be a number of things that dominate your desires. Jesus' teaching applies to all of them. It can be anything you can think of. The agents that destroy earthly possessions, they're not limited to just the moth, the rust, or the thief. There could be a number of things that happen. All things will be destroyed. Investments can go south. Money can become less valuable. You know, there's a lot of fear going around about inflation. Maybe someday our money won't be worth nearly as much as it was maybe last year. The economy can totally tank. This picture here is of a man by the name of Sam Bankman-Fried. I don't know if you're paying attention to the news right now, but he's the former CEO of FTX, and that's a cryptocurrency exchange. Now, I don't know the whole background of his business yet, and I think a lot of it is going to become more revealed this week and maybe in the coming weeks. I think a lot of it was really backed up in fraud, which is another story. That's not the point here. Imagine making a big investment in this company and losing essentially everything. In the height of the cryptocurrency and his company, it was worth, what does it say, like $26 billion or $23 billion, I can't read the back. Well, then through that, a lot of people began to start questioning that and question the real value of the cryptocurrency, and they all tried to start getting back their money out of this investment. And they did it all at once over the weekend, and they had to close exchange. Well, Monday it was worth more like $15 billion, and by Wednesday it was worth $1 billion. Thursday they valued it at $1. Now, imagine yourself, and you've invested thousands and thousands because you trusted that this would be it. This is going to be big payday right here. Cryptocurrency has been big, and I don't know a lot about it. I'm not going to go on about it, but maybe you thought that you're going to make a lot of money here, and you put thousands and thousands. Well, it's now evaporated right now. It's evaporated, and that reminds me of Proverbs 23, verse 1. This is not working right now, and I bet it'll skip ahead. So sorry. Proverbs 23, verse 5, as we read, for riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven. And that's the point I'm trying to make. You just don't know about tomorrow. You can't trust in that it's going to be just all right. It's simply dumb to think that you can ever insulate yourself from any and every catastrophe at any certain earthly value. There's really never a limit to things that could be lost. Even if you did, you would likely put all of your trust in yourself and not have trust in God anymore, and you have bigger problems then, and you have faith problems. You could be cut off from spiritual growth, and as we've established before, you'll stop bearing good fruit, and you'll become choked by the world's goods. You see, you can enjoy temporal things, but in comparison to eternity, if you just hoard all the things in this earth, it's a lot like people that tried to hoard, imagine trying to hoard Confederate money just 3 weeks before the Civil War ends. We all know Confederate money is completely worthless now. It's kind of like the same thing when you compare what's here and now versus eternity. Someday all these things will be worthless, and you need to remind yourself that. I need to remind myself that. Well, now there's Jesus presents with a contrast, and he talks about a more secure investment. Jesus mentions laying up treasures in heaven, and this, when we place our treasures in heaven, we can be sure it's stored up for good and will last for eternity because it's stored safely with God in heaven. No moths can ever eat through these treasures. Rust cannot eat away at this treasure. It can never be evaporated overnight. And when we invest in these eternal things, we'll be set. And we will continue to go after that, as we'll read in a little bit. There's no way thieves can steal what's laid up in heaven. The key choices and the choice in these verses is location. Location is important to God. It's very important to God. And we have a choice today to make where our possessions will go, where our best possessions will go. Will it be for God or for the temporal things of this world? You know, there's a lot of irony in this this thought of laying up treasures in earth or heaven, because the thing that I find ironic about it is that with these two contrasting goals, we often think of wealth as security, and I've already mentioned that. It's security from downfall or disaster. Most of us would like to mitigate risk, and that's okay thing to do. I think most of us do that. We buy insurance, right? We buy our investments a lot of times are diversified, and so we won't be in that situation there where it's going to nothing there. We have security systems to try to protect things from people stealing and so forth. In doing this, I think it becomes easier to fool ourselves into thinking that we can find peace, and we hope to gain an assurance, and that we're going to be safe through any storm or anything that should come upon us in the future, to save from financial ruin. And the ironic part is the more possessions, they don't offer us peace, the peace that we want. The magic number for contentment is not going to be there. You're not going to find it. And we're left with more insecurity. You're left with actually more anxiety. Now we have more things to lose here. Now we have more things that can decay. Now we have more things that can be stolen by thieves. And it would hurt us more to lose them. I think a lot of us have done this, but I ask you to count the cost of what you're going to buy. Count the real cost of what you're going to spend your money on. I'm not just talking about the ticket price. That's a start of the cost of something, but think about it from a holistic standpoint. What's it going to take to keep up with it, keep this up so it doesn't get worse and worse? You have to perform maintenance on whatever you buy, perhaps. You need to think about a thing to store what you just bought, right? You have to, like a car or a boat or something. You got to think about a lot of stuff like that. And then most importantly, and probably the reason why Jesus had such a problem with obsession with material things is exactly that. It's an obsession. You think about the cost. Think about the mental cost. The mental cost of buying that thing when you're thinking of a decision of purchasing something. How much storage is it going to have in your head? How much storage is it going to have in your heart? Are you going to be constantly thinking about it, constantly investing in this thing? How much is it going to cost you? In verse 21, where your treasure is, there is your heart also. And that leads us to the matter. Be careful where you place your treasure. It can lead your heart to God, or it can lead him away from God. Our heart is going to follow our possessions. It will. When we throw our possessions at something, our heart will follow it. And I have some questions again to consider. Do you want to make an impact on this community and shine your light to glorify God? Have you thought of finding people that need help and using what you have to help them? Do you want to have a heart to evangelize? I think a lot of us have want that, but do we have that? Have you put your money into it, supporting and helping an evangelist in their cause? Do you want to grow closer to the brethren here? Are we exercising hospitality? I'm pointing to myself too here. Do you really want to have your heart set on the church? Have you put your money where your mouth is? Verses 22 through 23 seem to be out of place in the first read. And I think you could vaguely apply them to desires and consumption in general. And I think there's truth to that strategy, but I don't think that's the point of those verses. It doesn't fit the context. Remember, they're just before where Jesus is telling us to lay our treasures. And then what's just after is talking about serving God or money. Well, I think the original meaning for the audience is simply this: for a good eye, I'm quoting here from Lightfoot in his commentary. For a good eye to the Jews is the same with a bountiful mind, and an evil eye is the same with a covetous mind. So what's the application? If the eye is clouded with covetousness, it's going to be unsteady. It's not going to be pleasing to God. If our Christian priorities are straight, the material things should fall into place. We won't have to obsess over them. We won't have to be slaves over them. We won't have to be ill if we lose them. They're tools for us, not to trust in, but to use for God. When we use them for God, we place our trust in God. God doesn't accept, as we already know, the double-minded man, or hear his prayers in James 1, verse 6 through 8. If we have a single eye or affection, our actions will fall into their proper place. The eye was commonly used in connection as or susceptible to loving earthly possessions. Jesus was tempted by Satan. And one of the temptations, he was tempted by the lust of the flesh. Get this. Prepare bread out of these stones. He was tempted with the pride of life. And he was also tempted with the lust of the eye. Remember, the devil took him to a high place and gave him the view of all the things, everything he could imagine, I think, saying basically, I can give you the world if you just bow down and worship me. And if Jesus took that offer, we're so thankful he didn't, but if he took that offer, he would have received the most welcome reception in the world that is ever imaginable. No rejection whatsoever. Never have to worry about food. Never have to worry about being hungry or living a lowly life. Could have had it all. All he had to do was bow down and worship the devil. But Jesus saw through this a mile away, and he knew it all boiled down to two things: worshiping God or mammon. Worshiping God or the wrong things. You can only serve one master. Jesus knew that. And I wonder if that scene was on his mind as he talked about this in his Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 6. I wonder if he was thinking about that. Again, we can see the proper perspective in this world in 1 John 2, verse 15 through 17. Do not love the world or the things that are in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is of the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away in the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever. So now consider Matthew 6, verse 24. Jesus closes his set of arguments, I think, with the strongest contrast. And I think this drives home what he's establishing in verse 19, building. And he drives it home right here. You can only serve two masters. As much as many would beg to differ, there's only two. There's not many, many roads. There's only two. Only one master can rule our hearts, as much as many people would like to have a little piece of pie of one and another. No, it doesn't work that way. Only one master can rule our hearts. We can be slave to only one. It's easy to see this illustration. Imagine having two masters that have conflicting orders. If the two masters have conflicting orders, naturally, if you obey one set of orders, you are by contrast disobeying the other set of orders. You know, there are many spies throughout history that have, and I know there's got to be spies today around for countries to do the things, the dirty work for them and get them information. You know what they do? Well, they go into a foreign land or a foreign group of people and they disguise themselves and they pretend to have loyalty to that one master when really they don't. They're just gathering information. They're gathering treasures or goods or whatever they need to do to give to their true master. Now, who's their true master? It's not the one they're faking allegiance to. It's the one they're gaining the information and giving it to. That's pretty clear to see. That's pretty clear to see. Here, Mammon is personified as a false god. It competes for loyalty with the one true God. This passage is not condemn those who have some wealth. It's a call rather to prioritize our wealth. Are you serving your wealth or are you serving God? You can't have both because they will draw you in different directions. This is a call for allegiance. Just a couple of quotes. Perhaps the biggest problem in Christianity is the notion that we can pursue this world's goods and make them our top priority and drag God along for the ride. The other quote, if God be not the object of supreme trust, someone else will be, and it is most likely to be money. This is a stern warning. And as we established in our first lesson, but I think it's worth reiterating, greed is not a harmless pastime. It's a serious offense against God, just as one who lusts is an adulterer. Jesus taught that. One who hates is a murderer. Remember that John taught that in his epistles. So also one who is greedy is an idolater. Paul said that, Colossians 3, verse 5. Jesus in Luke 16, verse 13, Luke records Jesus using the same phrase as Matthew 6, verse 24 phrase. And the application print, and it serves as an application for that parable of the shrewd manager. You remember that parable? This, to me, in my opinion, is one of the more difficult parables to interpret, to think about. And I only mention it because the principle of the two masters is used as an application or a conclusion for it. Remember, the manager was caught wasting the master's money, right? And the master said, give an account for all of your stewardship. You're going to be thrown out now. And he thought, what am I going to do? I can't go anywhere. I can't do anything. I can't see myself digging a ditch. I can't do all these other things. And he had an idea. He was going to go to all the creditors that owed his master money. He wasn't going to give his master all the money he was given, but he would give him a good portion of money. And what he would do here, this is what was shrewd and calculated, is he would go to each one who owed his master money and he'd say, how much do you owe? And they'd say this much, and he would slash their debt and say, if you pay right now, I'm going to give you this huge percentage. And they would. And he'd gather their funds. They can afford it now right away, pay it off. He could gather it, give it to the master. sort of pleased the master, but more importantly, he was making friends using the mammon of unrighteousness. Friends that would take care of him because he knew he was going to get fired, kicked out. These friends now trusted him and they loved him and they would care for him now that he lost his job. This was calculating. This was very shrewd. But Jesus praised this from a spiritual sense. And he said that we too need to be calculating with our gifts so that we too can ensure favor from a spiritual blessing. And if we apply the same calculated nature for spiritual things in efforts to grow closer to God and to be in His grace and so forth, if we are calculating that the same way that other people are calculated with their material things, imagine the good things that can be accomplished. He says in Luke 16, verses 11 through 13, "Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in what is another man's, who will give you what is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." This point is simple. It's what I've kind of been pounding a little bit. Use mammon for eternal pursuits. Be calculated on spiritual pursuits, the way worldly people are calculated in their physical pursuits. Use money, don't worship it. So what's the meaning of the passage as a whole? Let's pull all the verses together as we're closing. There are two locations where we can place our treasures, and we have the choice this morning, placing all of our treasures on the earth or placing our treasures in heaven. There's a contrast in views. We can have an eye set on evil or we can have an eye set on good. And finally, there are only two masters to serve. There are two masters that we can serve. There's God and then there's mammon. When it comes to goods, there's two choices. Choose wisely. These are some hard sayings for sure, I think. But how can we apply them? Jesus goes on to apply them in the next several verses. And I remember good lessons from our brethren that have given these verses. It's not appropriate or the time for me to give them, but just reading the next verse, verse 25. "Therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you'll eat, what you'll drink, nor about your body, what you'll put on. Is not life more than food and body more than clothing?" This doesn't mean that we need to live careless or irresponsible lives. It means that we are to live a life that's not divided or not obsessed with worldly goods and material needs. That's what it means. Paul wrote to the Thessalonians and rebuked them for idly waiting around, waiting for the second coming of Jesus. And really, that produced more problems than it helped. He said that instead they were to labor with their own hands. They were to work for good. They were to provide for their families and for others. But there is, however, a difference between providing versus hoarding and not helping the church and not helping others. And to me, I think that's one of the takeaways. I was talking with another brother a little while back, and I'm still kind of set on this. I think one of the best principles in the epistles when considering possessions is found in 1 Timothy 6, verses 17 through 19. "Command those that are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, who gives us richly all things to enjoy." How do we do this? "Let them do good, and that they be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life." How do you store up treasures in heaven? Again, the key is generosity. If you have excess and you see someone in need, help them. Consider growing as a giver. You know, we talk about growing in our talents, but are we thinking about growing as a giver? Also, may I use the phrase 2 Corinthians, "grow in this grace also." Have you thought about that? Have you considered that possessions are your responsibility? They're not just blessings, they're a responsibility too. Do you give the same amount of collection that you've given years ago, even though your income has increased? You know what that means? That means you're giving less and less. And you think about the virtues. Think about what God expects out of Christians. You think about any other talent. Does he expect us to just level out? Does he expect us to die down and get less and less in any other thing? Why would he expect us to give less and less as the years go on? Why would that be an expectation to him? I'd rather challenge you and challenge myself that could you possibly even not only hang with the same percentage as you give, but maybe even consider raising your percentage in giving as you've been blessed more? Have you considered that? Imagine the good that can be accomplished if we apply ourselves in this manner along with other things. Again, we can change. We can do so much good, and we can change the lives of so many people and win for the cause of Christ. Again, on the growth side, are you tempted by materialism? Do you have a priority issue that you need to fix? Do you want to think about God more? Do you want to think about the kingdom more? I implore you, just as Jesus taught in these verses, put your treasure there. Put your things there. And your heart is going to follow. So those are the thoughts I have this morning. And I wonder if there are any that are subject to the gospel call. First of all, do you know what the gospel call is? Well, the gospel is that Jesus, he lived, he died, he was buried, and he rose again on the third day. And he ascended on the throne on high, and now he reigns. And he offers forgiveness to everyone who comes to him. How do you come to him? You come believing. Jesus said that. If you believe not that I am he, you'll die in your sins. You come repenting. Jesus said, I tell you no, but unless you repent, you shall all likewise perish. You come confessing. Jesus said, if we confess his name before men, he'll confess us before the Father which is in heaven. And then you come being baptized for the remission of sins. Mark 16:16. If there's one who's taken these steps and fallen, why don't you come repenting? Why don't you come confessing? We can have prayer. If there's one of you the case, please come as we stand and sing.